This is an interview of Colonel David Gray Belmier, retired United States Air Force, in his home in Lewiston, Idaho, April 17, 2011. Colonel Belmier was born August 21, 1919, in Kansas City, Missouri. Colonel Belmier is being interviewed by his daughter, Janine Teach. Colonel Belmier was a veteran of World War II Army Air Corps, 15th Air Force, 304th Air Division, 455th Bomb Group, 743rd Bomb Squadron. What were some of your early training experiences?
Well, first, I didn't know very much about the Army and all, and they figured that, well, they'd pay me a little extra money if I joined the Air Force rather than joining the Army, and the draft board was nipping at my heels, so I thought I'd better go down and sign up, get my pick, and so I went down to Fort Leavenworth, is where it was, Kansas, and they signed me up in September, around the 21st, I think it was, of 1941. And in turn, I met a lot of other people that were signing up, and one of the people had a car, and so we made a deal with him to take us where we were going to go, and we were to be stationed at Glendale, Arizona, Thunderbird Field. Later to learn that it was a private company, Southwest Airways, was the one that was training cadets there. It's quite interesting that Glendale, Arizona, because something that we'd never seen before, we saw the airplanes we were going to fly, Stearman's PT-17s, which had a blue fuselage on them and yellow wings. And I got to thinking, why do they make such colors? And I guess they could, if we went down someplace, they could find us easier. The unique thing about the place was we had civilian pilots also. It was non-military, and we found out later on we took check rides with the company check officers. And then later on, the second lieutenants, who we thought were God Almighty, would check us for the Air Force, or for the Air Corps then. And I was lucky, I drew a Hollywood stunt pilot for an instructor. Well, I didn't know what I was getting into, and nobody else would say much, but he was always doing these fancy things that only a stunt pilot could do, and I was trying to learn how to fly. I think he flew just for the heck of being able to fly, to have a lot of fun. But I didn't realize it until about the day that I had to take my solo ride, and he said, he jumped down and says, "You got it." And when I started flying the airplane, I didn't realize he'd been helping me on the stick the whole time, so I didn't know what was going on. And so I think I really taught myself to fly. While I was there at the primary field on December the 7th, 1941, that's where one Sunday morning I was walking down the street in Phoenix, and the news came on this little newsstand, and they told us about the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and we said, "Where in the heck is Pearl Harbor?" And didn't realize that we were really in a war now, where it's going to be people are going to be shooting at one another. After graduating in December from Thunderbird Field, I was transferred to Mitter Field, north of Bakersfield, a little town called Laredo, California. And there we had BT-13s and BT-15s made by Consolidated Voltee. And they were single winged aircraft. We learned to fly formation, take off in formation, the radio, learned cross country. One of our trips was all the way to Yuma, Arizona and back. There we also learned how the Army operates. We had our Army barracks. They even issued us rifles. and a lot more military drill, and I had a lieutenant for instructor in the aircraft. After about 3 months of training here, I was transferred to Stockton, California, where I was introduced to AT-6s, which is a single-engine aircraft, all silver. There's no paint on this one. And I've learned a lot of pursuit tactics, including it had a retractable landing gear on it. But at this place is where I graduated and received my commission and also the rating of a pilot in the Army Air Corps. And that was on 23rd April 1942. From there, I was transferred to Kirtland Field at Albuquerque, New Mexico. And there I was introduced to some older type aircraft, which they didn't fly for long, but I got checked out in one. Anyhow, it was a B-18. It was a twin-engine bomber, but it looked very much like a DC-3. In fact, that's what it was a converted DC-3. But mainly, I have about 700 hours in less than a year's time in a AT-11, which is Beechcraft. And each I trained as a pilot to fly bombardier cadets. We had two cadets and one instructor on every flight. But that's where they learned, I take them out on the bombing range, and it's where they learned to bomb. From there, I was transferred to about a year in May of 43, and to B-17 school down at Hobbs, New Mexico. And there I got about 60 or 70 or 80, 90 hours, I don't know, something like that, in a B-17. And it was quite a transition from a twin-engine to a four-engine aircraft. After completed training there, they shipped me up to Clovis, New Mexico, where I was checked out and made a B-24 instructor. While I was there, that's where I first joined the 455th Bomb Group, and was introduced to our bomb group commander, Colonel Cool. And his method of flying was quite abbreviated compared to what I've been used to. We did not make 10-mile approaches to the runway. It was just right down the downwind leg, you know, racked it up and set her down on the runway. That's where they flew B-24s. Well, from there, we transferred from several little stations here and there and everything from Alamogordo, New Mexico to Salt Lake City Air Base. And finally, we did end up at Langley Field, Virginia, which was nice. It was more or less an old-time permanent base. There, we trained as a combat unit flying formation and dropping more bombs and getting a lot of ready for combat. After some entry schools and everything at Langley, I was introduced there to my squadron commander, which was David. He was a captain then, Captain David Thayer, who was the CO, commanding officer, of the 743rd Bomb Group, which I was transferred to. During this period while I was there, they promoted me to captain. We were getting ready to go overseas, and they knew because Cool and Thayer and a couple of other officers in our bomb group had been overseas in combat in North Africa and probably the lower Paleste raid. And they knew what we needed to have when we got into combat, so they had a lot of our supply people going up to Allentown, Pennsylvania, which was northwest of us, they're not too far away, and picking up somehow or another, they got their hands on all the tire tools and generators and starters and everything else and plugs and everything else you need for maintenance in a combat outfit, and we were loaded with everything. In fact, we were so loaded with it when we processed overseas from Mitchell Field in December of 1943. There and the other officers, they take all that stuff out of the airplane, don't have anything in the airplanes at all, to be stripped. And we did, we found an old barracks there and put everything in there. The whole bomb group did this thing. They take all that stuff out. We had bomb bay racks built into the airplane. They were part of the, come from the factory with these big plywood bins they set down in the bomb bay, and we could carry extra supplies that way. Tire tools and everything else. Well, we didn't know until we were ready to take off the next day that they went around and put extra engineers' kits and gunners' kits and everything in our airplane, outfitted our airplanes. They said, well, you got to have all these kits when you go overseas. We found out we had duplicates by the time we put our stuff in there. We left, landed at Morrison Field from Mitchell Field, New York, and there we spent the night, and there they gave our navigators the papers that showed where we were going to be sent to overseas. We weren't supposed to open it until 2 hours out on our trip. Well, when they opened it up, the navigator read on the internet, on the interphone, that we're going to Djedda, Tunis. Djedda, Tunis. Where is, well, we found out it was in Africa, but getting there was something else. We were supposed to go down to Belém, Brazil. We went from there, from Morrison Field to Barrancas Field, Puerto Rico, to Trinidad, had an air base there for the night, went on down to Belém, Brazil, at the mouth of the Amazon in Brazil. It was quite interesting. There, by oddity, was that a man was filling out his clearance there, and his was Colonel Joe Miller, who had an old-time Air Force West Point graduate, and I knew him before I even thought about getting in the Air Force. From there, we flew to Fortaleza, Brazil, over the jungles of Brazil, and we were spent about 5 days there waiting for clearance to get to the next field. The reason being was they had so many bombers going overseas at that time, they had to wait until the bomb ahead of us had to clear out a little bit so that they had room for us on their base. Colonel Joe Miller, by the way, was the 453rd Bomb Group commander who went to England. Now, we were at Fortaleza, Brazil, backed up because of all the flying fields ahead of us were all saturated with aircraft, bombers everywhere, and mostly bombers. And so we had to wait 5 days before they had any room for us ahead. So finally we got our clearance to go from Fortaleza, Brazil to Dakar, Africa. That was 11 hours and 30 minutes it took us to cross there. And we got a little apprehensive at the very last because we run into a lot of headwinds just off the coast of Africa, and we thought we'd never get to Africa. From Dakar, Africa, we spend the night, and they have room ahead of us. So some of them were going into Tindouf, Africa, but we were lucky, and we got in to Marrakech. It was a unique African city that was all dark, reddish plaster all over all the buildings, so it gave you quite a unique thing to look at the buildings. And we spent the night there, and I about froze to death there, I remember, because it was so dang cold. In fact, I threw my blanket in with the co-pilot, and I jumped in the GI cot with him, and he didn't complain. It was so cold. From there, I went up to Oran, and spent the night there and gassed up again, and then went finally to Djedda, Tunis. We finally found out what Djedda, it was about 20 kilometers west of downtown Tunis. So that's where we spent almost a month there, pre-training and flying local missions out of there, although we flew no combat out of there. I got sent early to my CO on me to go ahead and get in our field up in Italy, which was at Cerignola, Italy, which is west of Naples, over on the Adriatic side. This was in January of 1944.
Why were you nicknamed Rube?
Well, when we first got there, it was a pretty feeble camp. A lot of the enlisted personnel were in pup tents, and it was raining, and they weren't taught how to ditch their tents properly in a big mess, and they were drinking Italian red wine. And be a dozen officers to a pyramidal tent. So finally they cleaned out some, I think they might have been old stables or something, although they did have a fireplace in them, so maybe they were apartments. And I got the top bunk of three bunks when I first moved in there. But finally, when the CO came over, I talked to him, and I thought, why don't we just, everybody else is out in the olive orchard, why don't we just dig back in the side of this hill here, and then if there's ever any bombing or shooting or anything going on, we have a half a chance of not being hurt. He thought that was a good idea, so I and my buddy, who was my assistant operations officer for the squadron, we had no crews, and for us, we had no crews. Went made arrangements with the Italians. They were very handy with masonry work, so they put down sandstone blocks the size of a pyramidal tent up about 4 feet high, and then they even covered with plaster and calcimined it, and we bought some tile, and they put down a nice tile floor, and we had a nice tile porch in front of it. But we dug back in the side of this hill, and even put a little fireplace in there. Then we decided, well, we need some running water, so we got a hold of an old Wimpy tank. That's a twin-engine British bomber. This big tank was, and filled it with water. We had running water. We had the water truck come by there and top it off, because this was the CO's tent. So we had a really nice plush setup with that, putting a pyramidal tent over that. You could raise up the flaps on the side in the summertime, and you still had a wall there to protect you, so it was really nice. Well, when we got over there, there wasn't any place to take any showers, and the best the guys could do is fill their helmet with water and take a sponge bath. And that, of course, not too many guys were taking their baths like they should. So there happened to be a little stream running right down in front of us, not too far away from our tent. And I thought, well, there's water running there. Boy, there'd be a nice place for a shower. Well, each squadron had a bunch of little Herman Nelson gasoline transfer pumps for gasoline. I said, we got one of those. And I took got the Corps of Engineers that were in there to cut a gasoline drum in half long ways, and then set another full drum on top of that, and we could put fuel oil in the bottom of that thing up on a tower, and then that solid drum had filled it with water on top of that, so you could light a fire in there that heat the water in that top drum. Then put a can with a bunch of holes poked in it with a piece of baling wire hanging on a valve, and you could stand underneath that shower, and you had at least a halfway warm dish and a warm bath. Boy, it was, everybody in the camp, I couldn't keep water in the thing. We had to make sure that everybody had to service it themselves. So finally, my CO said, you're a regular Rube Goldberg, because I engineered most of the building of the tent and building the shower. And so all the way, ever after that, I was named me a Rube.
Can you remember a time when you almost got killed?
Well, that may sound funny, but there was a time that I dang near got killed over there after flying so many missions. At the top of this little hill where the Wimpy tank was placed. Just before that, a man came down to see us, and I didn't know he was there, but he came down in the Jeep about some flight schedule or something. And we had been cleaning out the tent and put all of our baggage in the center of the floor and sweeping around and doing ready cleaning. And I happened to be standing by the front door, which is on the opposite side of the fireplace. The fireplace was back against the hillside. And with the little Italian helper, Giuseppe, and all of a sudden there's a big crash, bang, and something hit me on the knee, and the tent all came down, and I said, what happened to my knee? There's a Jeep bumper. What? Jeep bumper? And I heard somebody say, oh. And I had yelled at something to the Major Bechtel, who was in the lower double bunk. When the tent roof come down, it just folded up that double-deck bunk, and he was underneath. I thought it was him that was doing it, and somebody else was yelling. I said, who is it? He said, I'm in under the Jeep. What? So we went and looked under there and dug all of getting out all of underneath it, all the canvas and everything, and here was this guy underneath there. You could see his legs in underneath the Jeep, and I asked him what happened. He said, the Jeep started rolling down the hill. He thought it left it in gear, and I guess it didn't. Well, it run right across, knocked the chimney and everything off the fireplace, went through the roof of the tent, and drug him in there and landed on top of him inside the tent. And he happened to land, fortunately, on all the baggage between him and the bottom of the Jeep. So I had Giuseppe run up to get the ambulance, which they did. Captain Housen came out lucky on that mission. He was only in the hospital 3 days. He only apparently got scratches. Well, there's pictures of that Jeep sitting in the middle of the floor. And they wanted to knock down the front part of the thing and take it out. And I said, you take it out the way it came in. It goes back up over the way, pull it back up over the hill where it came down from.
What was unique about the B-24s?
Well, it was a later model heavy bomber compared to a B-17. The B-17 had a good head start on heavy bombers as far as the year in which they were constructed compared to a B-24. It was a good airplane, very stable on B-17 was, but it had lower horsepower than a B-24. And consequently, it had a large wing on it that would take it right up to 40,000 feet without thinking about it. And the B-24 was lucky if they could get over 20,000 with a load on it. The B-24 had four Pratt & Whitney engines, whereas the B-17 had Wrights, W-R-I-G-H-T-S. And consequently, because of this, and being a later model, of course, it go faster. It didn't go higher. It would carry a quite large bomb load and go quite faster. And, of course, everybody that's flown their aircraft, as far as they're concerned, it was the best aircraft, whether it was a B-17, a B-25, or B-26, or a B-24.
And how were the crews of the B-24 organized?
Well, it was about the same as the B-17. You had a pilot and a co-pilot and a navigator and a bombardier, which were all officers. And the enlisted personnel were six airmen. You had a top gunner, ball gunner, tail gunner, and two waist gunners, and a radio operator. And some of them doubled up as being a gunner also. If you're a radio operator, you double up as a gunner. But they had the two waist gunners, and you had the tail gunner and a ball turret, which was very effective because it hanged down there, and the enemy did not think about it. If they dropped down and tried to shoot you from underneath, that there was a ball gunner down there to meet you. And of course, there was that nose turret, which they later on later models of the B-24, they put a nose turret on the aircraft too.
Do you have an outstanding experience that stands out in your mind about the crew?
Yes, one was a Lieutenant Haney, Richard J. Haney. He's my co-pilot on this one particular mission because I had no crew and we had Crew 17 along, but I did need a co-pilot. And so he went along on this mission. Well, after we had dropped our bombs, we were at 20,000, and somebody says, "Oh, you got a hung up bomb back here." Oh, geez. And I could only imagine it was hung up by army wires. There was an army wire on the tail fuse and on the nose fuse. And when the bomb went out, those army wires stayed in the airplane, but they'd be pulled out of those fuses. And then the little propeller on the nose of the nose fuse could spin. And after it had completely spun, then the nose fuse was armed. And I don't know about the back one. I think it's armed as soon as the wire was pulled out. But anyhow, there was a hung bomb, and it was dangling back there and banging around on the catwalk and everything. And when they announced that on the intercom, Lieutenant Haney rushed back there and whatever he did, but he kicked it out somehow. He got it out, and it left the airplane. So he saved the airplane and the crew. He came back, and he fell right between the seats because he passed out. We were at altitude, and he didn't have his oxygen mask on. And at that time, somebody was yelling something, and I couldn't do anything because I'm flying the airplane in the formation. And so the top gunner dropped down and put the Haney's oxygen mask back on him, and he revived him, and we went home, and that was it. So many little tales like this always happen, but a lot of times I don't think the crews ever got popular recognition for such things. But he did save our airplane and save all of our lives.
How was the B-24 equipped for the crew?
Well, besides the responsible positions, each one of them had a job, whether it was firing machine guns or flying the airplane or what. But there were a lot of little innovations that were equipped in the airplane that you could use in doing your duties as a crew member. Sometimes the radio operator wasn't needed when we were making a bomb run or anything like that. He could be running the, being a waste gunner and protecting the aircraft. And the other crew members, some of them were confined in a small space, like the tail gunner is a pretty small space, and the ball gunner above everything. In the time of combat, a lot of those poor soldiers didn't get out of there because something happened to the rigging and they couldn't manipulate turn the ball down to where he could climb up and out of there. It's a sad thing, but that's the way it worked. And the airplane had a lot of little innovations on it like that. And plus the crew was given a lot of equipment. They called them flak suits. You put those on a kind of a fish, like a vest, made out of fish plate. And the pilots had one they carried as a little skirt they could tuck down between their legs. And then the waist gunner standing up, there was more or less of a long little apron, like made out of fish plate too, besides the one up above in their vest. They usually put that on underneath their parachute harness. Another thing, the aircraft had a unique thing on it. There were coffin seats made for the pilot and the co-pilot. That sounds weird, but they were actually looked like a coffin the way they were designed. They looked like a big cast iron coffin seat, maybe 8 or 10 inches deep in back of the seats. They were flat on top with angled down for the shoulders and then a long slant down towards the base. And when we got jumped or going into the particularly or in a onto a target where there's lots of flak, the pilots would slide their seat through back into that coffin seat indenture and spend the the time back in there hoping that they didn't get any front end blast of flak. And there were a lot of little things like that, plus relief tubes and stuff like that scattered around throughout the airplane. And so everything else was automatic as far as the crew had to take care of them and be sure they were in operating order.
How did you receive your DFC Distinguished Flying Cross?
Well, they had a target for the day for the bomb group was to bomb an oil refinery at Buda and Pest. Incidentally, they're two cities. And it was right in the fork in the where the rivers come in there. And on the way there, we noticed that it was burning badly and big fires going and smoke in the sky, but it was pretty well destroyed. Somebody else had been there for some reason. We thought we were the only ones supposed to destroy it. But on the way there, we came across our secondary target, which was Csigled Marshalling Yard. That's Csigled, Hungary. It was disloaded, and it was at the time that the Russians were pushing the Germans out of Yugoslavia up and pushing them north. And we saw all that smoke and everything, and why drop our bombs there when we could do more by dropping our bombs on that marshalling yard because it was loaded. So we turned around and we all discussed this with the bombardier and the navigator and decided that's where we'll go. So we turned around and went straight right down to that place there and took all of our sweet time because there wasn't any flak there either. So we pretty well worked it over. They won't be moving much stock out of that place. When I got on the ground, it was my CO said, why didn't you bomb the primary? He said, they're raising hell about it already up and down the line about why we didn't take out the primary. And I said, well, what's the secondary for if the primary had been destroyed? Well, I was kind of downhearted. I thought they didn't see the situation at all. So later on, my CO came running into the tent and he said, you did the right thing, Rube. They always call me Rube because of my... And I says, how's that? He said, the general of the Upper Grove, who was the commander of the 304th Air Division, was there that day, and he saw what you did, and he thought you did really the right thing. And so I never thought much about it, and the first thing you know, they advised me I was going to receive the DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross, for that mission, because I'd done the right thing. And so I didn't feel too bad after that. Later on, they had a big parade at the base there. We were out there on the flying field at our base, and General Updegrove presented me with the DFC, and I was really happy about that. Getting a decoration like that by a general, I thought that was nice.
What happened on your last mission?
Well, needless to say, everybody was a little bit teamed up about it, and naturally, being in operation, I could have picked any mission I wanted to go on, I suppose, but I always took potluck, whatever came around, because I'd fly one time, my assistant would fly, take the crew 17 and go another time, and my COO, and we were always acting as pilot and co-pilot for one another, so we didn't mind too bad. But on this last mission, the whole airplane was filled with people getting their last mission in, the 50th time, the 50th mission. And so everybody was a little apprehensive about it, and we thought we were kind of going on what they call a milk run, but that's when there wasn't much flak or anything. So other than that, we just were a little bit steamed up about it. This was our last time out. So on the way there, it is always a habit when you're getting pretty close to 20,000 feet, you're out over the Adriatic, and everybody was test firing their guns. So we just got through test firing their guns, and I noticed the lead ship, I was the deputy, was pulling up kind of high a little bit all the time, and I was having a terrible time. I keep having to add the throttle to the aircraft to make it pull a little bit better and everything. I thought, gosh, and he was kind of acting like he wanted to stall or something. I don't know. Just everything didn't seem right. Maybe because I was a little apprehensive anyhow. But so I thought, well, if I just dumped about 5 degrees of flaps, that ought to help me stabilize this thing and not want to feel like it's going to stall out or something. Well, that's the worst thing in the world I could have done, I found out later on. Because all of a sudden, the airplane just went stalled or something. It wasn't any shaking or anything in the aircraft. It just went down like an elevator, straight down, in the same position we were in when we were flying. And, oh, my gosh, there was a bedlam in the aircraft. Everybody was flying around trying to get on their chutes, and if they didn't have them on or whatever, getting ready, trying to bail out, and you couldn't because everything was floating around in the airplane. You didn't have anything unless you were hanging on to something. And it kind of dawned on me what happened. Something happened. I said, well, I'm in a stall, so I pull the power back and drop the nose down a little bit. Right away, it stiffened up in a hurry, and boy, I milked those flaps up real quick-like. And I got to thinking later on just exactly what I did do wrong. It took me a little while to think about it, but what happened was, by dropping those flaps down, it blanketed that out, and the attitude that the aircraft was in, and the angle of it, blanketed out my tails, because the controls were just free. I could just turn them any which way. And I thought, some sucker has shot my cables out, because we'd just been test firing the guns. And I mean, it shows how you really get steamed up about your last mission. So finally, by dumping the nose forward and everything, I pulled back power, and I yelled to everybody, hold on, I got a control, nothing wrong. And so it took me about another 2 hours or something to get back up into formation. Well, we got over the target. It wasn't too bad. It was a simple little thing like a knock-on on a railroad bridge at Brod, Yugoslavia. And there was flak around, but at least it was the last one. We got on the ground. I think most of us were kissing the ground, believe me.
How do you think your wartime experience affected your future life?
Well, possibly, you might say, growing up a bit, you have a lot of respect for your fellow man, and it's not so much of what you did for your country, but you feel like you've accomplished something, and you developed some strong comradeships between some persons that you knew for that short period of time that you were in combat. And to this day, you relish having known some seemingly very closely related persons. They feel the same way that I do. I think nearly every soldier that been in combat and served with these fellow men has a very strong affinity or something.
Bond
with his fellow man. To this day, we keep in touch maybe once or twice a year. And to date, of the six enlisted men, there's only three, unfortunately, they're living with their wives, are still alive, and the two officers that were left over from the original crew, 17, are still alive.